Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And welcome to this, the third hour of our Olympics special, where we're featuring bits and pieces from the past, but also some selections from ABC Radio National's Religion Archive, including material that has appeared only in the past couple of weeks. In a moment, we're going to hear a little about spirituality from a quite different angle. Have you ever thought of the connection between spirituality and spirits? Not ghosts. Spirits, the alcoholic kind. Yes. Taking you out of yourself? Indeed. But much more. Mark Franklin will be along in just a minute or so with Philip Moore, a man who's turned his attention over recent years to spirits of the clear and runny sort. Then Andrew West will join us with journalist Peter Hitchens, brother of Christopher, and unlike his committed atheist brother, Christopher Hitchens is a committed Christian. The difference between Peter and Christopher, we shall find out in just a few moments' time, when Andrew will join us. And then, in our final hour, a treat, a musical treat from the Blind Boys of Alabama and Australian historian Geoffrey Blaney. That's coming up in the next couple of hours this Sunday night. Right now, let's say hello to Mark Franklin and The Good Life.
Spirits. It might seem like a funny word to describe alcohol, but oddly enough, spirits and religion, the spiritual, have a close association throughout history. That's our topic of conversation this week on The Good Life, with me, Mark Franklin, on ABC Radio and on your pod. Our guest this week is Philip Moore, an enthusiast in the distillation, the history, and the properties of spirits, although he assures me he only imbibes them in moderation. Philip was one of Australia's premier herb growers, but in 2003 he sold his herb business and a few years later bought a traditional copper still. He now runs a boutique distillery named St. Fiacre's, after the 7th century Irish monk. It specialises in spirits that are infused with Australian native plants. Alcohol, Philip says, has been closely associated with various religions throughout history. The monasteries of Europe gave us many of the popular drinks sold in bottle shops today. The spirit Benedictine was invented by Benedictine monks. Frangelico was invented by Dominican monks and is sold in a bottle shaped like a friar. Chartreuse was invented by and is still manufactured by Carthusian monks in the Chartreuse Monastery of France. Although some religions prohibit alcohol, it is an integral part of others. In Christianity, wine is an essential element of the Eucharist. In Judaism, wine is drunk every Sabbath and on most festivals. Philip Moore believes alcohol is integral to religion because it elevates human consciousness to a state that is more susceptible to the mystical and the sublime. I visited Philip at his slightly noisy distillery, and it gets noisier as the interview goes on. But to start with, here is some more refined noise from Orff's Carmine Burana, the tavern scene. I'm standing here with Philip Moore, the distiller at St. Fiacre's Distillery on the Central Coast, in the still room, where there is a massive copper cauldron that feeds into another cauldron with many pipes and windows and dials going everywhere. It looks very sophisticated, Philip. And there's a sign on the wall reading, Gloria ad Spiritum Sanctum.
Yes, that's glory to the Holy Spirit. If you're religious, there's a message for you, and if you like drinking, there's another message for you, and if you're both, well, there's two messages you can take home.
What are the messages?
Spirits are quite nice, and they can enable you to reach a higher plane.
All right, we'll come to that in a minute, Philip. Tell me about the word spirit. Why is this word used?
Well, originally when they first evaporated the alcohol, the vapour would disappear into what they thought was the spirit world. And then when it condensed, say on a cold surface, they thought it had returned from the spirit world. And consequently, they thought that alcohol may have more than a little magic associated with it because of its journey to the spirit world and its return. There's also another explanation for spirit. Originally, there were the four essences, which were fire, earth, water, and air. And then the fifth essence was the soul or the spirit of the actual object. And so when you distilled something like, say, a wine, you're actually extracting the soul or the spirit of the wine by the distillation.
Well, because the word spirit also has the meaning of essence, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. That's where the word quintessential or quintessence comes from, because the quintessence was the fifth essence of the actual object that you were working with.
So the process of distilling, then, is about drawing the essence.
It is, yeah. And that's probably why the alchemists were very keen on distillation as well, because they were looking for the elixir of life, and they thought by repeated distillation maybe they could reach this purity which would be helpful in as an elixir.
Where was alcohol first distilled?
They think probably about 500 BC, anywhere from Egypt through to China. And they have found stills, I think, even in northern Pakistan, dating back to about 500 BC.
You mentioned the alchemists there. Who were the alchemists, and what did they have to do with alcohol?
The alchemists were the scientists of the day, and they were looking for the philosopher's stone to change lead into gold, and they were looking for the elixir of life. And they thought, because of this distillation changing a liquid into a vapour and then back again, that maybe they had something that they could transform other things with as well, and thereby find their elixir or find their philosopher's stone.
And it was these alchemists who brought the science of distilling to Europe.
They did, yes. The Arabs or the Moors invaded Spain in about the 7th century, and distillation was taken up by the monasteries. They would preserve their medicinal herbs in the alcohol.
Of course, because in the Western tradition, it was the monasteries that developed the first distilleries. Tell us about that history. Why were there distilleries in monasteries?
I guess because they were centres of learning, and they're also centres of for healing as well. Monasteries were often places where you'd make a pilgrimage to, because certain monasteries would be expert in healing certain diseases, and so therefore being able to preserve their herbs in the alcohol was very useful for them.
And what types of ailments would a distilled spirit be prescribed for?
Well, really virtually anything. If you look at, say, a herbal pharmacopoeia, there are herbs for virtually any disease known to mankind. So you would have a vast range. You might have 100 or 150 different herbs preserved, and you could make selections of them. Four or five might go together to treat a kidney problem or something like that.
Is this kind of like making tinctures?
It is, yeah.
So whereas lavender might be used, for example, for treating sleeplessness, one might distill a tincture of lavender by putting the lavender in alcohol and giving this as a remedy for sleeplessness.
Yes. Mm.
And of course, the fact that monasteries were the first ones to develop alcohol is evident in the fact that we have drinks like Frangelico and Chartreuse. What are some other of the monastic tipples?
The two most famous ones are Chartreuse and Benedictine, and they both are very nice to drink. Benedictine contains 38 herbs and spices, and Chartreuse has got 130 medicinal herbs. So I guess they probably would have been a tonic originally, and if you were sick, you'd just roll up to the monastery and with your sore toe and get a glass of Chartreuse and then go home feeling a bit more affable.
Not a bad medicine.
I think so. Put you in the right frame of mind for being healed.
Well, yes, it was St. Benedict who famously said a little bit of wine is good for the soul. Alcohol clearly is an integral part of some religions. It's forbidden in Islam. So it's interesting that it was the Moors who first brought distilleries to Europe. But it's used ritually in Christianity and in Judaism. Why do you think that is?
It probably dates back to pre-Christian and pre-Judaism time, because a lot of religions have built on previous religious activities. Alcohol has been associated with religious celebrations way back to Paleolithic times, and the shamans were responsible for fermenting and distributing alcohol in ceremonies. So yes, it has had a long history of association with alcohol.
How would you describe the effect of spirits on one's consciousness?
Well, I think they definitely leave you open to accepting mystical experiences or religious experiences much more so than if you are sober.
Isn't that a bit of just an excuse to get drunk, though?
Well, it is, but also, many different cultures have used many different plant materials in order to alter their state of mind and then take part in religious ceremonies.
So elevating people to a more ethereal state for religious purposes.
I guess so, and just making you a much more open and receptive to that.
What was it that that made you want to open a distillery?
Well, I guess I've always had a keen appreciation of alcoholic beverages, maybe not to excess, more from a analytical and connoisseurial point of view. I had a herb nursery for 20 years, and I decided I'd use my knowledge of herbs to actually make liqueurs in the tradition of, say, the monasteries, which use a lot of herbs, but I decided to use Australian native herbs instead.
And why did you name your distillery St. Fiacre's?
Well, I was looking for a patron saint of distillers or booze, but there didn't seem to be any, so I chose the patron.
Surprising, given some of the things we've just been talking about.
That's right.
But sorry, go on.
So the St. Fiacre is the patron saint of gardeners, and all of the drinks that I do here are based on plants, and my background is, in plants. It's set in a garden, a fragrant garden here. It used to be called the Fragrant Garden, and so basically it's very botanically orientated.
Yeah, distilling spirits is all about infusing alcohol with the essence of herbs and plants, isn't it? Can you tell us a bit about the art of it or the science of it?
Well, basically, when you're distilling, you have a mixture of water and alcohol, and your water will boil at 100 and your alcohol will boil at 78, so you heat up the alcohol to about 80, 82. The alcohol comes off as a vapour, and then it is condensed back down again to a liquid. And this enables you to select out the nicer fractions of the alcohol. So you get rid of the methanol fraction, you get rid of the higher alcohol fractions. And what's left in the middle is called the heart, and that's the nice drinking. And if it's done properly, it should give you a beverage that gives you much less hangovers than something that hasn't been distilled or has been distilled poorly.
So spirits are a kind of purer form of alcohol, or maybe a cleaner form of alcohol in terms of the effects on the body than other types of alcohol?
They can be. The white spirits, especially like the gin and the vodka, are the purest spirits of the lot. They contain very little in the way of these higher alcohols, whereas the brown spirits are not quite as pure, so they will tend to have more of a deleterious effect on you the next day. Drinking the white spirits, you stay quite alert for a long period of time compared to, say, drinking brown spirits or maybe wine or beer. So I think they are a lot purer and they have a lot less side effects on the body, but at the same time they elevate your consciousness.
And what types of herbs do you use in the spirits that you make?
Well, I decided to concentrate on the Australian natives, and I've got things like aniseed myrtle, pepperberry, lemon myrtle. And then I do a gin in which I've put four Australian native plants. I've got the wild lime from Queensland. And from New South Wales, I've got macadamia nut, Illawarra plum, and cinnamon myrtle, which gives a spicy element to the gin, which all gins must have.
Now, as I was walking into the distillery, I saw an interesting note on the board out there, which was saying that apparently scientists or astronomers have discovered that alcohol exists naturally. It's naturally occurring in outer space. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, that's right. There's thought to be massive clouds of alcohol. They measure billions of kilometres across. One of these clouds is located near the centre of the Milky Way. It's about 26,000 light years away from Earth, so it'd be a bit too far to go to get a bottle of alcohol and bring back. But they think that alcohol came to Earth on meteors.
Alcohol came to Earth on meteors, a gift from God, perhaps.
Absolutely, yeah.
Philip, thank you very much for being my guest on The Good Life this week and for showing me your distillery.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
Philip Moore, owner of St. Fiacre's Distillery, talking about the history of spirits and their close association with religion over the centuries.
Thank you, Mark. You're on Sunday Nights. John Cleary with you, guiding you through our Olympics special program for Sunday Nights, where we're hearing from some of our colleagues on Radio National and other places. And Andrew West joins us now. A week or so ago, a couple of weeks ago now, before the Olympics, the big celebration in the UK. Queen Elizabeth on the throne for six decades, marking her Diamond Jubilee. And one prominent British Conservative and a strong admirer of the Queen is asking if the woman who is also Supreme Governor of the Anglican Church has done enough to defend the Christian heritage and character of Britain. He's Peter Hitchens, as irascible as his brother, but coming from a completely different direction. Here's Andrew West.
Peter Hitchens, thank you for being part of the program.
My pleasure.
How central is the institution of the monarchy to faith in British life?
I think it might be the other way round, actually. I think that continued existence of the monarchy, which I'm not by any means sure can be sustained very much longer, is a recognition in our system of government of the sovereignty of God. And in fact, the coronation service, which, of course, nobody has seen since 1953 and which people have forgotten, is very, very specific about this.
Will you, to the utmost of your power, maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel, maintain in the United Kingdom the Protestant Reformed religion established by law? Will you maintain and preserve inviolable the settlement of the Church of England and the doctrine, worship, discipline, and government thereof?
All this I promise to do.
One of the problems that we face in modern Britain is that when the next coronation service comes around, I cannot myself see how we can conduct it in the way in which it was conducted in 1953, because we have become, in the intervening years, so irreligious, so indifferent to faith, so unable to believe that it might have any importance in our lives. I think there's a very big strain between the two things.
Yes, I'm looking now in front of me at the coronation service, June 1953. It is an Anglican liturgy. It's a Holy Communion service. You think that that is simply not going to be possible for the Prince of Wales when he assumes the throne?
Well, I hope that it's possible, but I have to say I don't see any sign that it will be. I think the pressures to make it a multicultural and a multi-faith and indeed an all-faiths and none event in a Britain which is legally committed, I have to tell you, to a formula called equality and diversity, which places the Christian religion on the same footing as every other religion, that is to say, on the same footing as Islam, Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, anything you like. That's what equality means in this case, and dethrones it as the established religion of this country. I don't see how they can conduct a specifically Anglican, Protestant, British coronation service of the kind that took place in 1953. I will be amazed if that is what happens.
Well, Peter, that might suit the Prince of Wales because, as you well know, there's been this long-standing quote that's been out there from Prince Charles and renewed again, I think I'm looking at an article from the Daily Telegraph in November 2008, where he wishes to be known as the defender of faith. So maybe such a multi-faith coronation would suit him.
I don't really understand Charles's position on this and a lot of other things. I know, for instance, that he is personally very committed to the continued use of the 1662 prayer book, and he's a traditionalist in many things. I think that what he was striving to say there was that there's a feeling, I think, among believers in God in Britain that we all need to huddle together a bit for warmth in the cold blast of indifference to which we're constantly exposed. I'm not sure he was saying what a lot of people have interpreted him as saying, or hinting that he would want imams and the rest of the religions in Britain present at the coronation. I just don't know. It might suit him. There are some contradictions about his position which make me unwilling to judge. When he becomes king, as inevitably I think he must, everything changes.
As someone who was a traditionalist, how central to faith has this particular monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, been in these 60 years on the throne?
She made it plain from the moment that she acceded to the throne that she saw her position as a religious duty. She's never been in any way retiring about making it clear that she is a firm and unshakable Christian believer. So in terms of simple affirmation of faith and the fact that she's always made it completely obvious and undoubted that that is what she is, then it's been a powerful influence in favour of faith in our society. Whether as a monarch she could have done more in terms of her potential to advise, warn and stand up against things which she disliked, whether she could have done more to preserve the Christian nature of our society, I'm not sure. The problem with the monarchy as a constitutional weapon is it's like a bee sting. You can use it once, and you will probably destroy the monarchy if you do use it. And I do look at the past 60 years and wonder at what stage the monarch might have stood against what's happened to my country in an effective way. And I think there are several occasions when it might have been so. Whether that would have destroyed the monarchy, I don't know, but it was a risk that she didn't take. And when people examine her reign in years to come, they may say, well, perhaps the moment should have come. Perhaps she should have said, no, this is beyond what I swore at my coronation to uphold. This is not what I swore at my coronation to uphold. This is, in fact, against what I swore at my coronation to uphold. But
well,
she hasn't.
Well,
and she won't.
I'm interested in exploring that a little, Peter. Can you give us an example of where you think there was an occasion in recent post-war British history where she may well have spoken out in defence of Britain as a Christian nation?
The problem is that, as with all stealth revolutions such as ours has been, the changes are achieved by salami slicing, piece by piece, and there's never anything big enough to say this is an issue over which I cannot compromise, and this is an issue where I can't give the royal assent to this bill. That has been the difficulty for in that side of things. I think the real challenges for her have been more constitutional than religious in terms of direct attacks on the nature of the country.
Well, in February this year, there was an occasion when the Queen did make what was considered a very significant statement about the importance of the church in the nation's life. I just want to play a little 20, 30 seconds of that for you.
Here at Lambeth Palace, we should remind ourselves of the significant position of the Church of England in our nation's life. The concept of our established church is occasionally misunderstood and, I believe, commonly underappreciated. Its role is not to defend Anglicanism to the exclusion of other religions. Instead, the church has a duty to protect the free practice of all faiths in this country.
Now, Peter, having heard that, is that the monarch making a defence of faith, or is she being, in your view, a little too compromising?
I think there is an element of compromise in that. Obviously, one does want to stand for tolerance of all faiths, but I don't think that's necessarily the function of the established church. The established church must stand for Christian principle above all, and for it to be established. There's a slight slippage there. To me, I must say, that's how I read it when I heard it.
In the sense that she was herself moving towards this idea of a defender of faith in general?
There's something slightly multicultural about it for me. And again, these things are always on the edge of a remark in a subtlety. No one ever stands up directly and says, well, actually, Britain is no longer formally a Christian country. This is no longer a Christian monarchy. We are now a multi-faith country. It's never been written down and said as such, but bit by bit it becomes the case. And I think that those words seem to me to be part of that bit by bit.
You're a defender, as I understand, of the establishment nature of the Church of England. Why is that?
Because if it goes, then the last formal recognition of the Christian nature of our laws and origin, of the Christian nature of our country, will have gone. I think that the establishment itself used not to be anything like as important as it now is. Its destruction now would be a symbolic triumph for those who want this country to be formally secular. They want disestablishment. I have to not want it. I'm compelled to defend it because I know that the enemies of what I believe in would rejoice if it happened. Because the enemies of Christianity would rejoice if the church were disestablished, then I think the friends of Christianity have to defend it, even though there are aspects of it that they might themselves not be particularly keen on. It has now become a symbolic battlefield which the secularists and the atheists want to win. They want to see the church disestablished. Well, in that case, I want to make sure it stays established.
There's a bishop friend of mine in Australia who is a very strong traditionalist, a great respecter of the monarchy. But he makes the point that an established church is essentially has to water itself down in a way that a traditionalist and a strong Christian like you would not like. If the head of state and the head of church are one in the same, it necessarily leads in a contemporary world to the church standing for very little.
I don't think it necessarily leads to that. It has led to that because, in many cases, the church has not been prepared to defend its principles. And it's given way, and most fundamentally it's given way, I think, on the question of marriage and everything that goes with it. But it's also given way on the question of education and a number of other things. It didn't have to give way on those things. When the church and the Christian religion fights the modern world, it's not necessary that the church always loses or that it always surrenders. But it has been the case in Britain over the past 60 years that that's what it's done. The fact that that's what it's done doesn't mean that's what had to happen. I think it's much more a reflection on the feebleness of the church in the face of secularization than on the nature of establishment.
Now, it's been said, including by the Queen herself, in various speeches over the years, that she takes to heart this idea of the servant monarch, the servant queen. How have you observed that in her reign over 60 years?
I think that she does regard herself, and I don't think there's any question in the conduct of her personal life, she does regard herself as a minister, and you know as well as I do that a minister is, that people think it's a government official, but in Christian language it is somebody who serves. She sees duty as the main driving force of her life, duty to fulfill at all times and in all places, to do the things she is supposed to do rather than things that she wants to do. I think it has been a life very much of self-sacrifice and self-discipline, where she's functioned entirely as a person whose task has been to be the respected, to have a kind of purity, to be above and outside the squalor of the secular world, to be beyond reproach.
She is said to attend church almost every Sunday, almost never missing an occasion, and yet the church which she leads does appear to be struggling. Your book, The Rage Against God, has a rather elegiac tone about it. What has become of the Church of England under this monarch?
It had happened to the church long before she acceded to the throne. There is this point one has to make over and over again. She's not the head of the church. She is the supreme governor, which simply means that she prevents anybody else from being above the Archbishop of Canterbury. She exercises no executive authority over the church, whatever. The head of the church is the Archbishop of Canterbury, not the Queen. And the whole point of the 37th of the 39 Articles is the Bishop of Rome, as they refer to him, shall have no jurisdiction in this realm of England. And that the headship of the church is a constitutional device to make sure that the church is independent of any kind of foreign control. But in terms of the decline of the church, it really began in 1914, as did so many of our misfortunes, and the First World War, when the political, religious and cultural establishment of the country all flung themselves into support of a war which was wrong and futile and which resulted in the deaths of the best people in the country. And an event from which we've never recovered. Not merely did we lose so many incredibly valuable people, the whole generation of scientists, of authors, of priests, of poets, of fathers of families, of engineers, of anything you like, a huge catastrophic loss of people, and also a catastrophic loss of the right to govern among our governing classes, because they had made a very, very serious mistake which had cost the country not merely a large number of valuable lives, but also most of its wealth. And no institution that was strong in 1914 has ever recovered from that. The process of decline which followed the First World War has continued and accelerated ever since, and I think it reached top speed during the reign of Elizabeth II.
You also, though, I think, point to a softening of theology in the Anglican Church. In your book, you make the point where you say that the penitence, the notion of penitence that was so central to the Anglican text, the Book of Common Prayer, is very unpopular now. In fact, very few clerics want to emphasize that.
Well, the whole liturgy has been rewritten, and it's been rewritten in language of devastating banality, but it's also been rewritten in language which has deliberately, as far as I can see, cut out the fundamental penitence of the 1662 book. And if you look at the difference between the two, it isn't just linguistic, it is also theological. I remember when I was making a small survey in the Oxford area in England where I live of which churches used the Book of Common Prayer of 1662, encountering in one very beautiful church a rather large, fat member of the clergy, who I asked, because I could see no notices, do you use the Book of Common Prayer? And he says this, and he looks at me and says, I know who you are. I know what you're doing. And then he said, I hate Cranmer's theology of penitence, with a real fury and passion, such as you very seldom hear in the voices of the Anglican clergy. They don't tend to get passionate about anything much. And he was really passionate against penitence. It suddenly came home to me that this is what it was really all about. It wasn't just about beauty and language and modernization. It was about a desire to put that aside. The Anglican service of morning prayer begins with a general confession. I've followed too much the devices and desires of my own heart. I am a miserable offender. It is absolutely penitential act, and it's essential to Anglican worship, or it was. Now it's either gone or it's been replaced by something much, much milder, and I think that has to be significant. They aren't prepared to be strong in that matter.
But what is the broader theological meaning that you're getting at there? Because it's a fascinating point that you make.
I think the broader theological meaning is that the Church of England has abandoned individual conscience in favour of social conscience. In many ways, it became, during the 1945 to 51 Labour government, a lot of the Anglican clergy regard themselves as Christian socialists who believe that the government of the time, the most left-wing radical government Britain had had since Cromwell, was a government which was bringing about the kingdom of heaven. And they believed that the church's task was more or less over.
And indeed, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple himself, was very much a leader of that school of thought.
Yes, that's right. And they gave up, for instance, at that point, their control over a huge number of secondary schools. Although the church had been one of the main founders of education for the poor in Britain, it handed over most its secondary schools, so oddly enough, not its primary schools, to state control in return for a pie crust promise of regular Christian worship, which of course has been almost entirely abandoned now in English state schools. It just doesn't happen anymore in any proper sense. It was an exchange of individual conscience for social conscience, and much of Anglican worship and much of Anglican prayer and much of Anglican involvement now is involved with campaigns against third world debt or general attacks on poverty as a whole, and statements which are, as far as I'm concerned, politically of the left. And there isn't really very much attempt to confront the individual with his conscience and to require the individual to be penitent, and there isn't very much mention of sin.
You didn't quietly author that line in the wonderful episode of Yes Minister all those years ago, Peter, where they said that Anglican bishops were now required to be a cross between a socialist and a socialite.
No. But
it sounds like it sums up your attitude.
Well, let's not go too far in this direction. There remain in the Anglican Church quite a lot of clergy who are serious, and even some bishops who seem to me to have some traces of seriousness involved. So let's not dismiss it entirely. We'd be worse off without it. But there is a weakness and a willingness to retreat in it. And there's also, as there is in so much of British life, a decline of a belief that the real purpose of religion is for the individual to confront eternity, to understand that he is a sinner, that there is no possibility of goodness without grace, and to swap that for the idea that a general social conscience, a general belief in doing good through taxation and welfare, through foreign aid, through charity, is all that's really needed. And the old, hard, individual Christian belief has been put to one side in favour of what I regard as a false religion of politics.
Well, let's come now to the current Archbishop of Canterbury. Rowan Williams has announced his early retirement at the end of the year. You wrote of him recently that he was a nice, furry, mild and useless prelate. I mean, is that your total assessment of Rowan Williams?
Oh, well, if I'd had longer, I would have said more.
More good or bad?
I don't know. I think you have to distinguish between the person and the Archbishop. And there's no question, if you meet him, as I have done, he gives off personal goodness. And I don't doubt it, nor do I doubt that his good intentions. But on what foundation does he then proceed? There doesn't seem to be any confident assertion in anything that he does of the Christian faith.
You say that Rowan Williams has had difficulty defending some basic Christian positions.
I think the whole church has had difficulty defending some basic Christian positions. If you look at the one fundamental thing which the church has failed to defend during really most of the 20th century, and certainly the first part of the 21st, it's the idea that marriage means what it says. The great lines in the marriage service: for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, sickness and in health, till death us do part, actually mean what they say. And I think that retreat, the acceptance of divorce, the increased willingness to remarry divorced persons, the compromises on that have been disastrous for the Christian religion. If it doesn't stand for that, then what on earth does it stand for? And if it doesn't stand for the strong marriage and the fortress of the family in the howling wilderness of modern secular society, then what does it have? And it has given up on this. At the same time, to have given up, as I've said, on being deeply involved in the education and nurture of the young, it's almost suicidal. The place where people learn the Christian faith is at home, in the family, and it's in Christian schools. And if you dismantle the married family or make it a temporary shifting thing, and if you remove yourself from the schools, then you condemn yourself in the end to a slow death. And that's what they've done. There doesn't seem to be any consciousness about this.
On a more stylistic or aesthetic level, your portrait of the Anglican Church, as you would like it, is a seductive one. I mean, it is, as George Orwell said, old maids bicycling to Holy Communion in the morning mist. But is that lost forever, Peter? Are you really yearning for the impossible?
Well, that's George Orwell's summary from a position of a slightly unhappy outsider who had been brought up as an Anglican and who had some affection for the Anglican Church. I don't see it as old maids biking to Holy Communion in the morning mist. I see it as the authorised or King James version of the Bible. I see it as the Book of Common Prayer. I see it as hymns, ancient and modern. I see it as a tremendous collection of inspirational and overpowering architecture and music. I see it as an enormous aesthetic and philosophical force for God in our society. And it still has all these things available if it wants to use them. But by and large, it turns away from them. The Book of Common Prayer is actually barely used in most churches. There are statistical ways of filling this. There are sort of old people's specials held at 8 o'clock in the morning and the occasional cathedral evensong. But in general, if you go to the main service in an Anglican church, it's conducted in a banal modern language. The hymns, ancient and modern, which became a very powerful part of Anglican worship in the 19th and early 20th centuries, have been largely abandoned in favour of trite modern ditties with poor music and worse lyrics. The architecture, well, where possible, they mutilate it. It's quite funny, actually. The modern Anglican clergy are often, especially if they're of the Catholic wing, dress up in robes of immense medieval splendour. But you can't let an Anglican dean be in charge of a great cathedral for very long before he starts some sort of hideous, pestilential modernization of it.
Well, I have
and
to
I'm
say...
I'm sure that if they followed the same practice with the great cathedrals and churches as they have done with the prayer book, they'd knock them all down and replace them with concrete lumps.
Well, it isn't restricted to Britain. I do know of a church here in Sydney that's being built, and I think the vestry is referred to as backstage, and the sanctuary itself is referred to as the stage. You make, over many columns and writing, a critique of multiculturalism that is widely shared. But there's an essential contradiction, isn't there, in that if you look at the one area of growth, and this certainly applies to churches in Australia, if you look at the one area of growth that it is experiencing, it is in some of Britain's multicultural communities, those Caribbean communities, those African communities.
You're making a mistake. You're mistaking multiracial for multicultural. Now, the two things are very different. I'm very happy for there to be a multiracial society. I don't have any problem about that at all, but it should have one culture. Multiculturalism is about saying that there is no accepted culture, that there is no longer a host country, that the country adapts itself to the needs and desires and requirements of as many groups of migrants as care to come, so that in the end you finish up with solitudes, all turned away from each other, facing their own altars, but turning their backs on each other and facing their own leaders, having their own communities. This has already happened in several British cities, where there are now, I take Bradford, for instance, where there are very large numbers of Muslims. And except in the general course of business or on buses or passing each other in shopping streets, the Muslim inhabitants of Bradford have nothing to do with the non-Muslim inhabitants of Bradford. It's two separate worlds existing side by side. That I cannot support. It's been a serious mistake to encourage it. You can have as many people as you like from as many countries in the world and as many cultures, as long as, in arriving in their new country, they accept that it has a culture and it has a history and it has laws and it has a language and it has a religion which are predominant. It doesn't mean it's not prepared to tolerate the practice of other religions. It doesn't mean it forbids the speaking of other languages, but it does mean that those who come and those who continue to live, having come, accept that these are the dominant parts of the culture and that they don't challenge them. Multiculturalism is actually used by those who want to dismantle the culture of an existing country as an excuse to say to those who wish to preserve the monoculture that they are in some way bigoted or racially prejudiced.
Your point is...
Which is a slander, but a slander before which an awful lot of people will naturally retreat. But you do have to distinguish very strongly between multicultural and multiracial.
Your point is well understood. I guess, though, I'm only saying that the kind of Anglicanism which we have discussed only moments ago is nonetheless changed by a number of these vibrant communities that are now forming big congregations in Anglican churches in London. They do have very different cultural expressions of Christianity.
Well, I can't really argue about that. It seems to me that there has been an enormous amount of acceptance and understanding of the great texts of the Church of England, particularly the Prayer Book and the King James Bible, all over the world. That is what held the Anglican Church together all over the world until, I suppose, the 1970s. There wouldn't be an Anglican Church anywhere from Africa to Canada where the liturgy wasn't the same and the Bible wasn't the same. It got rid of those texts, not wholly because it had a tin ear, but also because it found in them disturbing and worrying statements which it no longer wished to hear about what Christian faith is really about.
Peter, finally, I can't let you go without asking you a question that fascinates everyone in Australia, and that is about Rupert Murdoch, but it's very specific. In recent hearings before the Leveson inquiry, Rupert Murdoch's Presbyterian background was invoked, partly to explain his friendship with the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. To what extent do you think that anti-establishment, non-conformist religious tradition that Rupert Murdoch comes from explains a lot of his attitudes expressed through his media towards religion and towards the Queen?
Well, I have to say I'd never sought for a religious explanation of any of Mr. Murdoch's attitudes towards Britain. I always thought it was a straightforward, old-fashioned Australian, how shall I say...
Well, he is the grandson.
I don't want to upset anybody here, but it seems to me that there are some Australians who have, especially since Gallipoli, viewed England as, and again since Singapore in 1942 as well, who viewed England and Britain as not exactly an enemy, but perhaps a rather lofty, snobbish, overbearing society which doesn't really deserve them. I can see where that point of view comes from, but I've never seen it as having much to do with religion. And indeed, if you look at Mr. Murdoch's newspapers and television stations, there's not all that much evidence of very strong religious commitment in them either, or anything.
No, but there is a long history of antagonism towards the royal family.
As I say, it's quite a surprise to me to even examine the possibility that Rupert Murdoch has any religious motivations whatever. But if he does, then good. I hope that he repents of quite a lot of the things that he's done.
Well, on that note, Peter Hitchens, it's been a pleasure to have you with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Andrew West, Peter Hitchens, brother of the late irascible Christopher. And just as contentious. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.